partly out of curiosity, and partly just wanting to learn some things to see if it would help me help others. A number of years ago, I began a study of psychotherapies. I collected several books, and in my spare time, it sort of became my hobby. I just started reading, spent hours and hours reading the various views of counseling and psychotherapy in particular. Then I began to write, and I wrote several hundred pages, actually. In the midst of that study, I directed a tour to China. I'd directed tours before to Israel, and the people that went on those tours decided we should go someplace else, so we all decided to go to China. The deal is the guy who directs the tour gets to go free if he gets a bunch of other people to go, so these were free trips for me, and so we decided to tour China. Now, the flight to China is long, going and coming, and there are gaps during the tour. So I decided to take something to read and even study during the trip. And I chose to take that manuscript that I was working on pertaining to psychotherapy. So I packed my briefcase with the manuscript and several books, and off we went. We toured China, and we ended up in Hong Kong. Now, as director of the tour, it was my job to check people in as we met in those as we stayed in those various hotels. So we got to the hotel in Hong Kong. I took the passports out of my briefcase to go check in everybody that was on our tour, and I sat the briefcase down in the lobby in the midst of our group. I checked everybody in, came back, and discovered that my briefcase was gone. Somebody stole my briefcase. You've got to be kidding me. There was hundreds of hours and hundreds of pages in that briefcase. Thank God I'd taken out the passports. All they got was my manuscript. And I thought, all that work, gone. It was all futile. I did all that, and now it's gone. All that was worthless. It was useless. I have nothing to show for it. Did you ever do that? Did you ever have that happen? You ever work on a project or work hard to get something accomplished, and when you got it all done, you thought, wow, it was all futile. If you've ever felt that way, if you've ever had that experience, a preacher has a message for you. Not this preacher, another preacher. I'm going to preach his message to all of us. This is one of, I think, those profound lessons we need to learn about how to handle life. Will you join me as we look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1? This is not one of those books that you normally read. You might not even know where it is, so look in the index at the beginning of your Bible, find out what page it's on, and join me as we begin with verse 1. Ecclesiastes, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanity, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labors in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to its place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it.
The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be, and that which is done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has not already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come, but those who will come after. This passage consists of, first of all, identifying the messenger. That's real short, sweet, and simple in verse 1. Then, this messenger, this preacher, gives us a message. And that message is basically in the next two verses, verses 2 and 3. The rest of the passage are a number of illustrations of the message. So this is a typical Baptist sermon that has three points. The messenger, the message, and illustrations, metaphors of the message. All right, let's begin by looking at the messenger. Verse 1, the word of the preacher. The Hebrew word that's translated preacher was translated into Greek, and from Greek it was Latinized, and the Latinized version of the Greek word, which is a translation of the Hebrew word, is Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes means the preacher. The basic idea behind the Hebrew word, it was a speaker before an assembly. So he's not a preacher in the sense of the New Testament preacher. He's just simply the speaker before an assembly. He's assembled a number of people together, and he wants to deliver a speech. He further identifies himself as the son of David. Now, David had several sons, so which one is this? Well, the last part of the verse tells us that this son was the king in Jerusalem. That therefore indicates it must be a reference to Solomon, because he was the son of David, who was also king in Jerusalem. That's the messenger. The son of David, Solomon, king in Jerusalem, who's now assembled a group of people together to deliver a message. What does that tell us? Well, other than the obvious, I think there are a couple of things that are implied that become significant later in the book. For example, he was the son of David and ended up with a large inheritance. He had a lot of money. We'll talk about that later in the book. He was king in Jerusalem. He had power. We'll talk about that kind of thing later in the book. So just know that this messenger is in a position to deliver his message from experience, based on some of the things he's going to tell us later. But he gives us his message up front, without any other introduction. He dramatically says in verse 2, "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Whoa. What is the message? What is vanity? Is he talking about some kind of pride that people have when they look in the mirror? No. The Hebrew word translated vanity actually means vapor, breath. That's the basic meaning of the word. Did you ever go outside on a cold winter morning and see your breath? That's this word. It's sort of like the steam that comes out of a steam kettle. One fellow thought it'd be a good idea to say it's similar to smoke. Now, what's the idea behind vapor, breath, steam, smoke? And the answer is that all of those things are temporary. They don't last very long. You see your breath and it rises and dissipates. It only lasts a few seconds, not a whole minute. It's here 1 minute and gone the next. The second thing you could say about that is that it's absolutely useless. What do you do with vapor? Nothing. What do you do with the breath that you see on a cold winter morning? It's worthless. There's nothing. It's useless. There's nothing you can do with it. Well, that's his point. I'm going to choose the word futility, that it's futile. That English word comes from a Latin word that means poured out. And in English, it simply means useless. So the preacher's message is that something is useless. Now, we'll get to what that is in a minute, but at this point, he is just dramatically saying, useless, useless, vanity of vanity, vapor of vapor, worthless of worthless. Notice he says vanity of vanity. Now, we don't normally talk like that, and in English, we don't write like that, but the Hebrews did. And there are a number of other illustrations in the Old Testament, like Holy of Holy. Remember the Holy of Holies? That means this is the most holy. Or King of Kings. This means the greatest king. So when he says vanity of vanity, he's saying this is the ultimate vanity. It is utter futility. Matter of fact, I've entitled this message, Utter Futility. And I get it from this verse. That's the message. Utter futility. Then he says, all is like that. All is vanity. All is utter futility. Wow. That strikes me as a pretty pessimistic message. Does he mean everything? Well, he clarifies in the verse 3, where he says, what profit is there of a man of all his labors? Now, I want you to notice the text carefully, because in verse 2, he says, all is vanity. And the connection is, in verse 3, he talks about all his labor. So the word all connects verses 2 and 3. So he goes on to say that what I'm really talking about is labor, what people do. Their labor is what is vain. And what I mean by that is, what profit is there? Now I look at that verse and I scratch my head and I say, what does he mean, labor? Is he talking about work? Is he talking about going to work 9 to 5? Is that what he means is worthless? Some people would say that's got possibilities. But that's not exactly what he's doing. And the way I know that is he uses the word profit over and over again in this book. And by looking at those occurrences of profit, we get some idea of the kind of labor that has no profit. So what is utterly useless is some kinds of labor, and what he means by utterly useless is those kinds of labor have no profit. So what I want to know is, give me some specifics. What are you talking about? Well, let me give you a few examples. Turn to chapter 2 and look at verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with myrrh. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. I'm going to seek. I'm going to work at it. I'm going to endeavor to get pleasure. That's the labor. But notice what he says. This also is vanity. Verse 2. I said of laughter, it's madness. And myrrh, what does it accomplish? Now notice, he's talked about pleasure, and in the same breath, he mentions vanity and accomplishment. Same idea that's in those opening verses. So what he's telling us, among other things, is that when you decide to seek pleasure in life, That's what you're going to work for. That's what you're going to live for. That in the final analysis, it's worthless. It doesn't accomplish anything. It's transitory. It's temporary. It's worthless. All right, let me give you a second illustration. This one's real interesting. Look at chapter 2 and look at verse 18. He said, "Then I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." Now, it's obvious from that verse itself, he's talking about his possessions now, not pleasure. And the context bears that out. So what he's saying is this: look, I spent all this time and effort to gather things. And let me just tell you, that was vanity. That was vapor. That was useless. And here's my proof. I die, and it comes to the fellow who lives after me. I gave it all to my kids, and they squandered it. I mean, all the stuff I hoarded and collected, they sold at a garage sale for $1 apiece. It's all vanity. It's worthless. So what he's talking about, it's not all labor. He's talking about laboring for pleasure and laboring for possessions. But there's one more, and this, in a sense, is one of my favorite. Turn to chapter 3 and look at verse 9. He says, "What profit has the worker from all that he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end." This is a really fascinating verse and concept. And the point is this: there's God-given things for us to do, and we do them. But you know, in the final analysis, there are things about life you just can't figure out. You just can't understand. They're mysteries. Now, we're going to talk about these three and more as we go through this book. I just simply want to point out now that all Solomon is saying is that there is a vanity to life. It's temporary. It's like vapor. It's useless. In the final analysis, you give yourself to pleasure, possessions, trying to understand everything. And there's a sense in which it's all useless. Now, in order to fully appreciate this message, you need to understand one other thing back in chapter 1, verse 3. He says, "What profit has a man from all of his labors in which he toils under the sun?" What does he mean by under the sun? I'm going to give you three possibilities. Possibility number one is that Solomon is speaking from experience. He's speaking experientially. Matter of fact, this is a very popular idea. Preachers tend to preach this as if it's the point of the book. And the idea is this: that under the sun means without God. It's under the sun, not above the sun, is what they like to say. And their point is that, well, at some point in his life, Solomon backslid. And in his backslidden condition, he decided to give himself to pleasure, to collect possessions, to be philosophical and try to figure out all of life. And he learned these lessons from his personal experience. So one option is that under the sun means without God, and Solomon is talking about his experience. Second option is that it's more philosophical than that. It means without God, but Solomon is not necessarily just talking about his experience. It's not that he doesn't refer to his experience. It's that he's being more philosophical. Some people want to use this book as an evangelistic tool to show that without God, pleasure and possessions and all the other things he mentions are useless. So you've got to have God in your life. The third view is that he's speaking not experientially necessarily, primarily. He's not speaking philosophically. He's speaking realistically. He's just saying, let me tell you, this is a slice of life. That life is full of futility. In other words, in this interpretation, it's with or without God there's futility in life. Now, I've wrestled with this a lot. I've wrestled with it over the years, and I spent a lot of time wrestling with it this week. And finally, I read what other people have to say. I just want to know what Solomon had in mind. Give me a verse. So at one point, I just told my computer, print out all the references to this verse in all of the Bible. And what I discovered is it only appears in Ecclesiastes, and it appears in Ecclesiastes a lot. So I printed it out, and I decided to just read every one of them. I'd already gone through the whole book, so I knew what the book said. I just wanted to make sure I had this phrase down. Now, I can spend the rest of the afternoon talking about this, but I'm going to give you one verse to show you what I've concluded is the point. Turn to chapter 8 and look at verse 15. Solomon says, "So I commended enjoyment because a man has nothing better under the sun." There's our phrase. "To eat, drink, and be merry. For this will remain with him in his labor all his days in this life which God gives him under the sun." So he's not saying this is without God. He's saying God gave us life, and this is what we're supposed to do with it. And yet, there is a futility to it. So I've concluded that this is just a hard-nosed, realistic view of life. That you work and accomplish nothing. It's useless. You work your fingers to the bone and say, "What do I have to show for it?" You ever heard that expression? Worked all my life, and what do I have to show for it? Shakespeare puts in the mouth of Macbeth the words, "Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." Now, that may not be exactly what Solomon has in mind, but it's close. Or Thoreau said, "People live lives of desperate," what's the phrase? "Quiet desperation." You know it. That's something of what he's saying. Life is temporary and useless. Now, at this point, it does get better. Just bear with me for a while, will you? I'll give you the positive side before I stop. But you got to get the negative side, because that's what he's doing in this passage. We'll get there. Bear with me. At this point, he illustrates it. And he starts out illustrating it from just generations. Look at verse 4. "One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever." He said, just look. One generation comes, doesn't last forever. It passes off the scene, and another generation comes. And it passes off the scene, and the earth remains, but the generations go. I think a good illustration of this is a house. There are houses that were built in the early part of the 20th century in Los Angeles. You go back to New England, they'll show you houses that were built in 1776. So the house remains. Just drive down the street and pick out a house. How many families lived in that house? How many families are still alive that lived in that house? And that's his point. Generations come and generations go. But it's all temporary. The house stays, but they don't stay.
Or then he talks about nature, and this really gets at his point. He uses the sun, the wind, and the river. Look at verse 5. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. Now, don't get scientific with us here. It's the language of observation. It's just looking at the phenomena. And he says, look at the sun. It rises in the morning, races across the sky, sets in the evening. And what did it accomplish? It just goes back and does the same thing. It accomplishes nothing. Or he says, look at the wind, verse 6. It goes toward the south, turns around and goes toward the north. The wind comes offshore, and the wind comes from the desert, we would say in Southern California. The wind whirls about continually, and it goes again on its circuit. It just does the same thing. So right now we got winds coming off the desert, blowing all that hot air at us and going into the sea. Out next Tuesday, it's going to change directions, and the wind's going to come off the sea and blow in that cool air. I'm waiting for Tuesday. Stick around for a while, and then it'll come. Santa Ana will come and blow the wind off the desert back into our face, and wait a while, and the wind will. But it always goes right back and does the same thing. It's an endless cycle. Then he talks about the river. This one really gets his point. Verse 7. And all the river runs into the sea, and yet the sea is not full to the place from which the river comes. Then it returns again. Now, he's just looking at the river, and he says, wow, look at this thing, the mighty Mississippi. You ever been to the headwaters of the Mississippi? You can walk across the Mississippi on a few stones at the headwaters. And then it becomes the mighty Mississippi, and it flows down the continental United States, and it dumps into the Gulf of Mexico. And you look at that, and you say, wow. Never fills up the Gulf. Gulf stays the same. You go back and it starts all over again. Now, Solomon probably didn't understand evaporation and rain and the connection, but he did say, just look at it. It doesn't accomplish anything. It didn't fill up the sea. And that is his point. Earlier in the service, I read the passage in Romans 8, where Paul said, all of creation, because of sin, is given to futility. Paul and Solomon agree. Now, he's still illustrating, but let's finish the passage. Look at verse 8. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Again, you can't accomplish it all. You can't see it all. You can't hear it all. Verse 9, that which has been will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Now, this is where we get to the first great objection. There's nothing new under the sun. Can you object to that? Can you argue with that? Well, just look at all the new things we got. One person compiled the list and said, in 1879, Edison invented the first electric light bulb. In 1901, Gazette invented the double-edged razor. And a guy named Booth invented the vacuum cleaner. In 1902, Carrier invented the air conditioner. Thank God for Carrier. 1903, Henry Ford incorporated the car company, and the Wrights flew their first flight. In 1904, a guy invented the tractor. In 1929, there was the first transcontinental air service between Los Angeles and New York. In 1938, there was the first Xerox machine. In 1948, they had the first fax sent. This was particularly important. The phone line could transmit 1 million words per minute. So RCA sent 1,047 pages of Gone with the Wind in just 2 minutes and 21 seconds. And since then, we've got what? The internet, the cell phone, the iPad, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter. So how can you say there's nothing new under the sun?
You can say that because he's not talking about inventions. There were new things that came along in his lifetime. Obviously, that's not what he's talking about. There are things that never change. One author said, when you look up at the stars, you realize that they're the same luminaries that shone upon Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Think about that. Kipling said in the 20th century, the crass that we call modern, the crimes that we call new, John Bunyan had been typed and filed in 1682. There's nothing new under the sun. Let me give you the kind of thing I think he might be talking about. Somebody said, married folks are not to act as they usually do. The men are almost lions in their house, hard toward their wives and servants. The women, too, everywhere, want to dominate and have their husbands as servants. You know who said that? Martin Luther. Or there is the comment lamenting the sad state of marriage, one author wrote, and I quote, young people marry now on a short acquaintance without giving it much serious thought. They often do not consider it for a lifetime, but think that they will try married life, take a chance, and if it does not work, well, they can easily get a divorce. That was written in 1930. Speaking politically, somebody said, the budget must be balanced. The treasury should be refilled. Public debt should be reduced. The arrogance of officials should be tempered and controlled. And the assistance of foreign land should be curtailed unless we go bankrupt. People must learn again to work instead of living on public assistance. Cicero, 55 BC. There's nothing new under the sun. But in this context, what Solomon is saying is, there's nothing that's going to come along that's going to be new in the sense of making life not futile. It's going to be useless. And the way he describes it, what has been's going to be, and what's going to be in the future is going to be what's going on now. It's all going to be the same. Nothing is going to change. Verse 10, is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It's already been in ancient times before us. Your problem is you forgot. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor is there to be any remembrance of things that are to come. That's the problem. It's not that there's nothing new. It's that we forgot that it was way back when. All right. I've gone through the passage. Did you get the message? Can you repeat it? What's the message? A lot of human labor is temporary and useless, meaning that it has no lasting profit. I'm going to repeat that. That's the message of this passage, of this book, and I think one of the passages, one of the principles you need to learn to be able to handle life. A lot of human labor produces that which is temporary and useless. Things pass away without leaving profit. No advantage, no gain. Now, I want to end by clarifying some things. This is going to take a minute, but I think we need to clarify a couple of things. Number one, Solomon is not talking about your occupation. As a matter of fact, Solomon, who wrote the book of Proverbs, or most of it, said in Proverbs chapter 14, in all labor there is profit. And that, I think, is talking about your 9-to-5 job. Of course, there's profit in some of the things that we do. So let me remind you that in the book of Ecclesiastes, he's not talking about 9 to 5. He's talking about labor after pleasure and possessions and trying to understand life. That some of that is useless. The second thing I want to say, and this is very important, I think what Solomon is saying is that we need to have a realistic view of life. That's the point of this book. A lot of what we do goes nowhere. It is a routine. It's like the shining sun, the blowing wind, and the flowing river. A realistic view of life recognizes that life is full of trouble. Man is born of woman, is few of days, and full of trouble. That's Job chapter 14. Few of days and full of trouble. Sounds like an echo of Ecclesiastes. Job 5. Yet man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. So a realistic view of life looks at life and says, life is full of trouble. A realistic view of life understands that life is full of trials. Peter says, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trials, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. 1 Peter chapter 4. A realistic view of life says life is full of trouble. Life is full of trials. Life is full of tragedy. Life is full of tribulation. Through much tribulation, we shall enter into the kingdom of God. And I want to add to that, as does the book of Ecclesiastes, and life is full of injustice. And life is full of futility. So add that to our list. My job as pastor is to teach you the Bible. But as I've studied the Bible over the years, I've come to the conclusion that if you take a biblical perspective of the Bible, from a biblical point of view, then you're a realist. There are Christians who bury their head in the sand. They take an unrealistic view of life. Just listen to some of the preachers on television. It drives me crazy. God's gonna fix it so everything in your life is gonna be healthy, wealthy, and everything's gonna be hunky-dory. They don't read the same Bible I do.
That's right.
I wanna call him by name, but I'm gonna refrain. One of the most popular preachers in America right now is telling people something that is unbiblical, unrealistic, and unhealthy. The Bible looks at life with both eyes wide open and says, life is full of trials and tribulations. And if you don't understand that, you end up in the psych ward. I'm not kidding. I had a man tell me within the last week, his wife is a counselor, and she said, 100% of the people come to me, their problem is they aren't looking at reality. And having studied psychology, I can tell you that is exactly what they say, and that's exactly right. They'll call it living in denial. The Bible calls it living deceived. Those two things are not exactly the same, but they're close. So one of the things I covet for you as your pastor is that you look at the raw reality of life and say, that's what it is. I'm not real big on birthdays. It's in my family. My wife is. So we celebrate birthdays. That's fine. Finest birthday I ever had was last week. I'm going to tell you why. It was the testimonies I heard. Some lady got up and said, Mike taught me, and she said what I taught her. And she said, life is unfair. I almost raptured. I taught you life is unfair? Good for me. Because if you don't understand life is unfair, you're headed for emotional trouble. So I'm here to tell you the Bible is realistic. Open both eyes. And that's what Solomon is doing in this passage. He's simply saying there are things in life that are futile. People don't like that. They want to be encouraged. That's the most encouraging message I know. Because I know what to expect now. Hello. I promised you I'd give you something positive before you left. You got to hang with me through this book. This book is phenomenal. I love it. So let me just tell you, I think he's trying to give us a realistic perspective and what I'm going to call a spiritual perspective. I want you to turn to chapter 5 and look at verse 18. Chapter 5 and verse 18. Solomon says this, "Here is what I have seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labors which he toils under the sun. For," this is important, "all days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage." Did you see that? God has given us a gift. It's life. He's given us this day. So he comes to the end of the book and Solomon says, let me give you the conclusion to the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. So put these two things together. On the one hand, life is full of trials, troubles, tragedies, and on the other hand, God has given me the gift of life, and I'm to enjoy it. And he mentions in 5:18, to enjoy the good of all of his labor. Did you see that? To enjoy the good. And that includes eating and drinking. Not, of course, speaking of drunkenness. So Solomon preaches that life is a gift from God to be enjoyed. The teaching of the preacher is to realize that life is a fleeting thing and needs to be savored and enjoyed as a gift of God. One author says, in the context of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, the book of Ecclesiastes is saying, quote, "Wisdom involves seeing life from a divine perspective, trusting God in the face of apparent futility." May I repeat that? The message of this book is that wisdom, we're going to say lots about wisdom before we get done with this book, involves seeing life from a divine perspective and trusting God in the face of trials, trouble, tragedy, and futility. Another author said, "The preacher intends in his writings to pass judgment on man's misguided endeavors at mastering life by pointing out its limitations and mysteries. He would prefer that man replaces such false hopes with a complete confidence based on the joy of creation as God's gift." All these authors are saying basically the same thing. The spiritual perspective is to say, yeah, there's evil in the world, but God's given me the gift of life, and I'm to enjoy Him. He's given me relationships. At one point in this book, Solomon says, go home and enjoy your wife. Enjoy. Enjoy the day. Go enjoy a good meal in the face of all the trouble. I've had people say to me, I didn't feel like getting out of bed this morning. I didn't want to go to church, but I did anyway. Man, after going to church and having lunch together with other people and fellowshipping, I just felt so much better. That's the good gift of God. So when things are falling apart, go pick a friend and have a dinner. There's nothing more satisfying than that. A good relationship with somebody you love. Good meal to enjoy it with. So yeah, God gave us this as a gift. That's not to deny the other. It's to realize that both are true. So here are your options. Deciding that human effort produces futility, a lot of the times, you can have one of three different options. Number one, you can throw in the towel. You can throw up your hands and give up. You can just focus on the negative. That's what pessimists do. Now, let me tell you where that gets you. Then you just crawl into your shell and live alone. There is nothing that you can do that's worse than that. But that's what some people do. Throw in the towel and throw up their hands. The second option is the people say, all right, doesn't make sense out of life, so I'm going to live life to the fullest. I'm going to get all the gusto I can, any way I can, as much as I can. So that's going from one extreme to the other. I think the balanced biblical view is simply this. Here's your third option. Trust the Lord. Obey Him. Don't sin, as Solomon will say later, because we have to give an account to God. And in the meantime, enjoy the good gifts God's given you. A relationship with Him. A relationship with people that are near and dear to you. A good meal. I began by telling you that some thief stole my briefcase. Now what do you do? Well, the people on the tour decided they probably realized real quick there was nothing of value in it and threw it in a trash can. So some of the dear people on my trip went and looked in trash cans to find my briefcase. They didn't find it. So I grieved for a little bit. And then I decided, he stole my briefcase, but he's not going to steal me enjoying the rest of this trip. Right? So we got a wonderful dinner and a great hotel. The briefcase gone. Later I redid the whole work and it was better the second time. So here's the lesson. Thieves may steal your briefcase. Don't let them steal your enjoyment of life that God has given you as a gift.
Amen.
Father, thank you for the good gift of life. And we so often squander it on things that are useless. Help us to use life for the things you've given it to us for. To enjoy it. To joy one another. To glorify you in the process. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.